This morning, I would like to have us shift our attention to the social dimensions of our life as we think in terms of the general topic, Christian response in an uncertain America. And yesterday, I had done some reflecting with you about anxiety being very basic to our being human. To be human is to be a creature of anxiety. It is to live in a world in which we are affected by forces outside of ourselves, in which there are many things that happen out there over which we have absolutely no control and yet affect us very profoundly. Say the notion of having children. You have children, you don't know what you're bargaining for. You get married, you don't know what you're bargaining for. But then think of the arenas of our life which come to us in a way where we have no say or involvement at all, even our involvement in political life. And the decisions that are made for the citizenry as a whole and the nation as a whole and how that affects each one of us. The sense of being in a world threatened by thermonuclear destruction, that's something over which we do not have any control. And yet it affects us very profoundly, even now as we live. And at the same time, we are creatures that have freedom. And we are not sticks and stones, we're not avocados or giraffes. We can make some choices, we can make some determinations, we can set goals for ourselves, and it's that interaction between limitation and freedom that really establishes the nature of our humanity. And as I pointed out, we have a tendency to try and get out from underneath that, either trying to exaggerate our freedom in a kind of willfulness and aggressiveness, or a desire to control or manipulate. Or on the other hand, are running away from our freedom altogether in trying to hide within delimitation. And sometimes it takes interesting shapes. You know, you don't have to think that to be aggressive or to be manipulative, we have to do that in some obvious way. Sometimes we're very subtle. It's like the riddle, how many Jewish mothers does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is none. Don't worry already, I'll just sit here in the dark and suffer. See? Well, as Dan Greenberg said in his little book, How to Be a Jewish Mother Without Being Trying, you don't have to be Jewish or even a mother to learn how to be a Jewish mother. You don't have to be Jewish or a mother to be passive aggressive that way. We all learn those little techniques, how to get people to do what we want them to do and make people jump and dance all over the place. So we learn to control and manipulate, or want to control and manipulate in ways that we don't see. And that is our problem in many respects. Now, one other element that contributes to a Christian perspective on what's going on in our society right now, besides an understanding that there's always this business of anxiety just beneath the surface, comes in taking a look at the degree to which we are social creatures and that we are dependent upon and affected by our interaction with others and our sense of solidarity and connection with a community. We noted yesterday that the developmental psychologists point out the degree to which we need a basic sense of security, a sense of fundamental trust, and a sense of being valuable and productive and fruitful and wanted and accepted through all of our years. And that shows up in rather interesting ways. I think we all know something of that with the increased amount of mobility that characterizes American society. I was just talking just at coffee break before this session started with someone who was thinking about the possibilities of moving on and going to graduate school, but he has a young family and was busy talking about that. And I observed from my own experience, when I left the parish ministry and went back to graduate school for my master's and for my doctorate, my children were young. They were 3 and 1.5, and I said, it seems that the younger the children are, the more flexible they are because they're connected more to their parents than to a peer group. But a little later on, it's going to be more disruptive for kids. Well, it's not just disruptive for kids. Sandra and I picked up and left Fargo-Moorhead 5 years ago to move on to Ohio. We like it very much there. We're finding our home there. We're building connections there. But we discovered the degree to which a major move in one's mature years is profoundly disruptive and painful. And the analog that I use is that it's something like transplanting a tree and or a large shrub. You get out there, you know, and you cut off the roots and you ball up the roots and you let it sit there for a year to develop new smaller roots, and then you lift up this tree or this shrub and you transplant it. But you leave all that tissue behind, all that living tissue that's still there in the ground. And that's what happens when we pick up and move on. We feel a sense of social dislocation. We feel connections being broken. And that is a signal of the degree to which we are really part of a wider circle of connections, and the degree to which we are social creatures, despite the fact that we Americans like to think that we're such rugged individualists. We're not as individualistic as we might think. We are tied in many ways to communities of connection where we feel comfortable, where we feel secure. It's an issue of security, isn't it? We feel secure when we're tied into these organic communities where we feel a part of things. Willard Galen made an interesting observation, and I connected with it immediately because I grew up as a kid in New York City, and right up until the days that I finished college and seminary, I still was a resident of New York. And he talks about how even in the labyrinth of Manhattan, people develop a sense of connection and community. And how it's not unusual at all to see someone walk into the same luncheonette for coffee break or for lunch and greet the counterman, you know, "Hi, Charlie." And the answer is, "Hi, Bob. I'll have the usual." Okay. I mean, the fact that you can even say that, "I'll have the usual." Or sometimes it gets to be the case that the counterman knows automatically what Bob will have and has it ready on the counter. You know, there it is. You take coffee with sugar, without cream, whatever, you know, whatever it is. There's something very, very necessary about that, and people want that and need that, even in the midst of Manhattan. People have this sense of organic connection, a sense of belonging, a sense of place. So this kind of social solidarity helps keep insecurity and uncertainty and anxiety in check to some degree. We feel a sense of connection and we feel at home. But when that social solidarity is undercut or disrupted, when it's taken away from us, we feel vulnerable, we feel isolated, we feel anxious. We call it fearful, but it isn't as if we're afraid of anything particular. We feel anxious, and we may even feel angry and resentful. Now, I think that what we are experiencing in part, this is only, as I said, one slice of what's going on. I'm not trying to give a portrait of absolutely everything. But one element of what's going on in American society right now is widespread social disruption. It's not only the fact that we're America on wheels. I mean, you figure out, where's your family? Sandra and I count our kids, and they're spread from the Bay Area down here in San Francisco all the way up to Boston, you know, in the middle of the country. I mean, they're all over. They're scattered. That's not unusual, is it? I mean, I bet it's true for most of you, if not all of you here. That family, close family, siblings, parents, children, are scattered all over the place. And hence there is this sense of a kind of dislocation. Then you have to kind of find your place elsewhere. But it's more than that. It's what's happening to stable patterns of connection. And I mentioned the family farm crisis as one of those. Very powerful, very important, a very disruptive force in America today. Or else, think of what's happening in the area of the country where I live now, and what's now being called the Rust Belt. The Rust Belt, because these large industries are just sitting idle, and the factories are closed, and the machinery is rusting, and people are out of work. And whole communities now are shattered. Whole communities find themselves without a future, dislocated, and people are upset and angry and confused and anxious. But it's more than that. It's the fact that our communities are being disrupted in other ways, besides this kind of mobility and the loss of employment. It is a kind of internal disruption, a disruption of the values of a community. Because our solidarity with others is not only this sense of connection with other people in these kind of social contexts, it's the fact that we gain a certain measure of security from socially defined and socially affirmed meaning systems, as they are sometimes called. Now this too, let me bear with me while I become a little more reflective and a little more theological and philosophical at this point. To be human means to have a world and not just an environment. You know, out here, the deer that we meet on the path out here, they don't have a world, they have an environment. But the environment may even be modified. I mean, beavers have an environment and they modify it. They create dams, you know, and therefore they build a nice pool and canal systems. They get back into those choice young trees. So they modify their environment, but they still have an environment. But human beings have a world. We have a world. Because the context in which we live is not just the physical environment, but it's kind of a mental landscape. A landscape of meaning and value. And we are shaped in our humanness by this interaction with this wider world of meaning. And perhaps one of the most dramatic examples of that we can find around is the story of Helen Keller. Helen Keller, who was born seeing and hearing, but who lost her sight and lost her hearing and drifted into her own internal world, cut off from other people, and how she was a very uncontrollable kind of child and very willful and almost wild. There are some interesting stories told about so-called feral children. The most famous case was a boy who was found in France wandering around in the forests, wild. This happened back in the 18th century. And this wild child, this wild human being, somehow had become separated from parents and had managed to survive in the wild on his own. But what's interesting in the case of both Helen Keller and this feral child is that their full humanness had not yet developed or was being thwarted or frustrated because they didn't have this kind of creative contact and interaction with other human beings. And the most significant thing that happened to Helen Keller, as you know, was she learned language. She learned to communicate. And in communicating, what opened up to her was not an environment, it was a world. It was the human world that is expressed in and through our speech. So we not only make sounds, we have a language. We not only have an environment, we have a world. And it is within this world that we become humanized and that we become persons. our personhood is connected to these communities. And within these communities, we have meaning systems that tell us where things are at and what they mean. Meaning systems expressed in language and culture and the traditions of people and the stories that are told from one generation to the other, or the stories that are told within the nation. You know, we tell the story of George Washington, tell the story of Abraham Lincoln, we tell the story of Teddy Roosevelt, or we tell the story of the winning of the West, or whatever stories we tell. Those stories help define our world. Now, it'd be interesting, for example, to hear the stories that are told about the westward expansion of American culture and civilization as it would be told in Native American tradition. A different story. Therefore, a different world. And to understand the Native American perspective, you have to learn to listen to their stories and to enter into their stories. And then their world becomes a part of your world, or you become a part of their world. So the stories that we tell are important. Our narratives that we rehearse are articulating and defining the worlds in which we live. What happens when people start to tell different kinds of stories or tell about the same events that you already have tied down in the story and now they're telling it a different way? Or what happens when the stories that are told about the same thing differ? We still have yet to figure out the story of Vietnam. And wasn't the pain and the conflict and the disruption that we felt in the American community back in the 60s and 70s due to the fact that we could not agree on a common story about Vietnam? And we still haven't found a common story. And as long as we don't have a common story, there are not only different stories, there are different worlds. There are different meaning systems conflicting with one another, aren't there? And now we hear other people telling different stories. There are women who want to tell the story of women in a different way than women have been talked about in the past. And suddenly there are new stories or new ways to go about talking about what it means to be a woman. And you can't get more basic than that. Men and women have their identity established in these meaning systems, in these social connections, and now we discover that people are still telling these stories in a different kind of way. To be a man is not to cry. To be a man is not to show your emotion. To be a man is to be strong. To be a man is to sort of go out there and meet the world and take it on and deal with it and care for your family and so forth and so on. That's the story that's told. Now different stories are being told. There's a different kind of narrative about what it means to be a male. That males can cry and males do have feelings and ought to share them. That males can be involved in the rearing of children and so forth and so on. And on it goes. I mean, we're dealing with fundamental stories, fundamental narratives now, fundamental meaning systems that are built into our culture. And now we discover that they're are alternative meaning systems and alternative stories that are around. And that's becoming very disruptive. And therefore, the security we have from a kind of established, solid, unchallenged meaning system is now being shaken. And therefore, there's a certain measure of insecurity that's about, a kind of psychological or spiritual insecurity, uncertainty and anxiety. And it's troubling us. It's troubling us in many ways, very deeply. And when social solidarity breaks down, when we no longer have a shared world, when we no longer can sort of tell the same general story, then we find that our world becomes filled with uncertainty, confusion, and conflict. And that's where we are. American culture is becoming increasingly tribal, as some people describe it, pluralistic, and it's subject to change, in fact, a much disruptive change and far-reaching change. And Whenever that happens, the uncertainty and the anxiety that social systems help keep in check, when that social structure begins to have cracks in it, that anxiety and uncertainty begins to bubble up through the cracks. And that's what's going on with us right now. That uncertainty and that anxiety is bubbling up, and people are feeling nervous, and they're feeling frightened, and they're feeling angry. And when this happens with a small segment of the population, it always does to some degree, because, you know, social systems are always being disrupted. Human beings are always having their lives wrenched. But when it happens to large numbers of people, then we're in a very, very precarious time. Because then there's widespread anger. And we begin asking things like, who's responsible for all of this? Who's causing all the trouble? Who's lousing things up? Who's making me feel nervous? The anxiety is there all the time, but as long as the social structure is in place, we don't feel it. It helps keep it in check. Now, with that being shaken, now we're looking for someone to blame. And we keep trying to find those who are the troublemakers. And you can pick your own list. You know, everybody has their own list of who the troublemakers are. If we only got rid of them, or if we only kept quiet, or if we only got them in line, then everything would be fine again, see? Because they're the troublemakers causing it. And in the realm of religion, you hear a lot about that, you know. It's the moral majority, they're the troublemakers. Or it's the secular humanists, they're the troublemakers, you know. Whatever villains you want, you've got them, as we keep looking for them. We want to know who's causing the foundations of our world to be shaken. So when sizable numbers of people begin to feel this kind of anxiety and uncertainty and anger, then it becomes a very troubling time for a community, for a society or a nation. This is exactly what happened in Weimar Germany following the First World War. And because of the incredible disruption people were feeling, meaning systems collapsed. The whole meaning system of the 19th century collapsed around them. You know, the whole notion of the emperor and the empire and a safe and secure world and everything, science and technology all producing progress and so forth, all these notions came tumbling down. And then on top of it, all the social disruption and the economic distress, especially the economic distress, when you hit people in their pocketbooks and they have hungry children, they get very, very angry. And so into that arena step people with the solution, the answer, and identified the problem. Who were the troublemakers? It's the Jews. They're the ones, said the Nazis. It's the Jews. Or it's the capitalists, said the German communists, and so forth. So everybody had their scapegoats. And then people started to jump on bandwagons, figuring, we can fix this and we can get this back to where it was. So that's something of where we're at. But the anxiety goes even deeper. The disruption goes even deeper. Now, here I'm going to get really abstract, but see if you can follow. At stake is what one sociologist calls our basic reality kits. Each one of us has a basic reality kit. These are the things we never think about. They're all the things that we assume. When I say this is real or this is true, we all have assumptions about what real and true are about. That's not something we question. That's not something we think about. It's something we all assume. Therefore, a widespread American, I'm going to call it a prejudice because that's what it is. A widespread American prejudice is, for anything to be true, it has to be a fact. And if it's not a fact, it can't be true. That's why myths aren't true. I told a myth last night. I repeated a myth last night and tried to argue, hey, this might be true. But Americans have a prejudice that if it isn't factual, it isn't true. Hence, it's not surprising that a widespread assumption in American religion is, if Genesis 1 and 2 are not facts, it can't be true. And therefore, in order for it to be true, it has to be fact. See how that works? That's part of a basic reality kit that people pick up from the culture and never question. Our basic assumptions about what's real, what's true, and what's valuable. So, for example, let's think of someone in a third world culture, an anthropologist, talking to somebody, and this person says, I talked to my dead grandfather last night. And the anthropologist says, oh, this is interesting. Make a note of this. You talked to your dead grandfather. How did that happen? I had a dream. I had a dream, and my grandfather came to me, and he talked to me. And he told me some very important things. So I'm going to pay attention to what my grandfather told me. Well, an anthropologist, being well-trained, will always bracket that out and will sort of accept it at face value. You and I, what do we generally do? You know, we kind of laugh up our sleeves. Well, you know, these primitive people, you know, uneducated, pre-scientific types, your grandfather really didn't come to you in your dream. I mean, your imagination worked, and you thought it was your grandmother. It was only your subconscious or something inside of you, but it really wasn't your grandfather who came to you. Oh, yes, it was. It was my grandfather. You said, well, that can't be real. I mean, dreams are not real, and the things that happen in dreams aren't real. They're imaginary. Things that happen in dreams are not facts. And all truth and reality has to do with facts, and therefore dreams are not real, and therefore, I mean, you'd think your dead grandfather came and spoke to you, but he really didn't. That's because we're dealing out of our basic reality kit. But then along comes somebody like Carl Gustav Jung, a psychoanalyst, and starts talking about how very profound stuff inside of us is trying to communicate to us, and there are our own subconscious experiences and memories. But there also are deeper traditions. There are even kind of basic, a collective unconscious that we have as a culture and as a human race. There are great thematic things that come to you in dreams. You dream about travel or especially water and getting on a ship. It means you're at the stage of some kind of important transition in your life. You dream of something round and circular or square that's a common motif in human dreams that has to do with the very center of yourself. And when you talk about your dead grandfather coming to you and talking in your dream, you might as well take that as being real, because something about you, your grandfather, and what he meant to you and what he represented, that's trying to speak to you right now. So, in fact, it is real. Pay attention to it. So suddenly now we're beginning to learn that maybe dreams are kind of real in a certain kind of qualified way, and now we begin to pay attention to them. So what happens is our basic reality kit starts to become modified by psychoanalysis and by all sorts of things. So what we assume is precisely that. It's what we assume. Another example. Nothing is more basic than our sense of time. We all know what time is. Time is this ever-moving stream, as the hymn has it. We move from the past into the present, and now we face the future, right? And so we're kind of future-oriented. You're busy thinking at some level of your being about lunch. I'm really feeling hungry. And maybe you're thinking about what you're going to do this afternoon. And beyond that, now the bus is going to leave here. Are we going to go in the morning, in the afternoon? And when are we going to leave? We're leaving on Saturday, or we'll leave next Thursday. And I mean, that's sort of how we think about time, right? We're always future-oriented. And we tend to expect interesting things from the future. And that's very, very typical of Western culture, and very typical especially of Americans. We're very forward-looking. We always expect the future to somehow hold promise. We're very interested in the future. The future is always a good thing. Tomorrow, you know, like Annie sings, you know, tomorrow, tomorrow, there's always tomorrow. It's only a day away, you know, like have hope, and things are going to get better, and election time comes around, and what is it all about? It's all about the future, isn't it? I mean, you know, elect me and .. and it has to do with the future. And we're always looking to the future, and how we can improve things, and there and all of that. In Papua New Guinea, they really don't care about the future. They don't face the future. The whole notion, we even have that as a phrase in our language, don't we? Facing the future. Papua New Guineans don't face the future. They face the past. You don't walk forwards in life. You walk backwards. Because you can see the past. You know what's there. You know what's in the past. Do you know what's in the future? No, it's just like whatever lies in back of you. You can't see it. You can only see in front of you. And what you see in front of you is the past, not the future. When the future shows up, then you'll know what it holds. But there's no sense worrying about the future or planning about the future or being concerned about the future. It will somehow be there, and you'll just cope with it when it comes. And that's how time operates. That's a very helpful example. And what's our reaction? When you heard that, when you heard Gerhard talking about that Hispanic notion of living now, today, in the moment.
Irresponsible.
Yes, you irresponsible people. You've got to think about the future. You've got to salt something away. And who do you expect to take care of you in next year or in your old age or something like that? And we assume, therefore, that we're right and these Hispanics are wrong. And of course, the Papua New Guineans, I mean, they don't even understand what's real. But that's because we assume a basic reality kit. And we've absorbed it from our culture. We've learned it quietly and unconsciously. We've learned it. Get in a different culture, you can learn a different basic reality kit, and your whole perception about where things are at and what they mean and what's important will shift, just as Gerhard illustrated from the Hispanic culture. You may begin to treasure today very, very much. Maybe we're so busy living for the future that we forget to really live in the present. So we might cite all the values there are to our basic reality kit, but what we're overlooking is that it may also carry some liabilities, some deficiencies. There may be some blind spots in our vision of things. You see? Now, this is what we're discovering bit by bit by bit, and it's very disturbing. And it's disturbing because the basic reality kit out of which you and I operate is the basic reality kit of Western civilization and an American version of that. And this Western basic reality kit has been dominant in world history over the last several centuries. That basic reality kit has conquered the world. That basic reality kit is brought along every time we communicate technology or science or our political and social institutions and bring them to other peoples and other cultures. And it's associated with Western colonial expansionism. The fact that Western civilization spread itself out around the globe and imposed itself on the indigenous cultures that were there and came in with great power. Came in with great power. Just the other day, we stopped at the Custer battlefield, and I picked up a copy of the a description of the battle and had many different accounts, and among them, so these narrative accounts of the battle were some given by some of the Indian leaders at that battle, and one of them said something about how afterwards, after the battle, they had won a great victory and so forth, but gradually they were defeated, and finally he said something to the effect, we came to see that the white man is too strong for us, and that we must accept his ways because he is just too strong. So what happens? It's not just our institutions and our systems, it's the basic reality kit that also gets imposed. When we start teaching people science and technology. Our whole educational system is really geared to communicating the basic reality kit of Western civilization, subspecies Americana. See? And it has had great effect because the West has been powerful. The West has been powerful politically and economically, but also powerful technologically and militarily. And it isn't just as if Westerners have accepted the notion, the assumption, that this basic reality kit is superior. It's the subjugated peoples who have assumed that too. When you go to India, the Indian people in India, the educated people, assume that the Western basic reality kit is the basic reality kit and should be the operating one for the culture. Now, what has been happening in the last half century or so is increasingly the Western basic reality kit is being challenged around the world. And people are getting in touch with their own cultural heritages again and saying, this has value and significance. We're not going to buy into a Western set of assumptions. We ought to discover the dignity and value of our own assumptions. And what's also been happening is that this is happening in subcultures within the United States. This is precisely the black experience. Or even in other cultures, like the Native American culture. I remember going once to a powwow that was held in the Concordia College Fieldhouse in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I was right from the east, and this was absolutely fascinating to me to see this. And then there was a break, and then someone got up to make an announcement, and it was the end of the morning's session, and he said, and we'll convene again at 2 o'clock WPT. And everybody laughed, and then they started to disperse. And so I saw something, like, well, what's WPT? White people's time. It means by the clock. Because in their culture, time is more intuitive. Time operates not according to the clock, but it's another kind of time. It's like we say, well, you know, I feel now it's time for me to have to say this to you. You know, I know I've had to say this for a long time. It's not been easy for me to really have to confront you this way, but now's the time for me to have to say this. Or something else. I really think it's time for us to go on a vacation together. See, that kind of time, that free-floating time. What seems timely, see? Not just what's chronological. So sub-communities in our own culture are beginning to sense the values in their own cultures, in their original basic reality kits. And they're asserting them, and they're not buying into the dominant basic reality kit of our culture. And that's causing disruption, you see. And we're getting confused because these people are not accepting what we assume is the obvious superiority of our basic reality kit. I mean, it's obvious because doesn't everybody subscribe to it? And of course it's superior. It's proved itself in world history. Yeah, it's a fact. But it's an assumption. And now people are expressing the fact our basic reality kit is limited in many respects. And now we find some of our young people are attracted to the basic reality kits of other cultures mediated through other religions. And this too causes a lot of disruption. And the sense of social security that we have, the security that comes from having a coherent, cohesive social solidarity around us, is being shaken or cracked or challenged. And it's discomforting and disquieting and angering. So the more our Western reality kit is qualified, again, the more we feel disrupted. And this is happening and happening increasingly. And finally, the struggle between East and West. Let me just wrap this up quickly so we have some time for some conversation. This holds true in the conflict between East and West, between capitalist and communist economic, political, and ideological systems. What we are discovering is that something that Roman Catholics and Protestants have had to learn to deal with, namely, the other side just doesn't evaporate and go away. You've got to learn to live with them. And both sides have assumed that somehow, sooner or later, the other side is obviously, because it's so corrupt and so illegitimate and so obviously wacko in its value system, is obviously just going to fall apart or dissolve or be brushed away if only we just get our own act together. We can take care of them. Both sides have assumed it, and it's not happening. It's not happening. And this is a challenge. The fact that we have to deal with a major adversarial system is very, very upsetting. Why? Because it's one way we are reminded of the fact that we're finite, that we're limited, and that our value systems and our meaning systems and our social systems are not universal. They're not unqualified. They're not automatically, obviously accepted by everybody, but they're human, and therefore they're finite and limited. And that is very unnerving, because at the heart of every cultural system is a heroic notion about itself, that here we have the way of life, we have the answer to human problems, we have the expression of what it means to be a human being, we are obviously the epitomization of the whole of human history. All human history finally has flowered in us. And every culture has assumed that. I understand there are certain tribes, certain groups of people, I think it's the Cheyenne, for example, here among American Indians, that's an example of this. The name for their own tribe, they have names for everybody else, but the name for their tribe is equivalent to the human beings. Now, we're the human beings. We are the human beings, and everybody else is sort of, you know, a subspecies. Or in China, you see the Chinese character for China looks like this. It's also the character for the central station on the MTR in Hong Kong. It means central, or middle, or at the center. So because the name of the station in English is central, they use the symbol, which is the same for China. Why? Because the Chinese have understood that they are the middle kingdom of the earth. They are at the center of the universe, and everything else just revolves around them. Because they are obviously superior. The same kind of assumption now, and translate this to the struggle between East and West, you have this assumption of what has been called a mythical hero system. I mean, our culture is not just a political and economic system. Our culture is a mythical hero system. I mean, here we have latched onto something bigger than ourselves. It's almost bigger than death. It can defy death. This is powerful and wonderful and eternal stuff. And now suddenly we have a powerful adversary who disagrees with us in some fundamental ways and who will not go away. And what is this saying to us? You're not as heroic as you think. You're not as superior or obviously eternal as you would like to assume. And this is the really the deepest level of the conflict between East and West. It is not just a competition between economic and political systems or a different prioritizing of human values, but it is a conflict between mythical hero systems. And therefore, the other side is always seen as a threat. And this psychological spiritual threat is then objectified and made into a political military threat. And therefore, we find ourselves arming ourselves spiritually by arming ourselves materially. And the more armament we pile up on ourselves to protect our mythical hero system, the more the other side is arming itself, and we see that. And what happens? Both sides understand they are protecting something beautiful, powerful, precious, and eternal, and important. And the other side is being aggressive and dangerous. And what happens when our policies begin to fail? Our mythical hero system starts breaking down in our influence in the third world. Our mythical hero system starts breaking down in Central America. We begin looking for scapegoats and troublemakers and people who are undermining us. It's due to domestic bumbling. It's due to foreign subversion. It's due to inadequate amounts of power. And I bet a dollar to a hole in a donut, a ruble to a hole in a Bailey, that in the Kremlin, there are people saying the same thing about Afghanistan. How come we're not winning in Afghanistan? It's due to political bumbling and criticism here at home. In the ranks of the party, there are people critical of our policy in Afghanistan. If we would all be united behind it, get behind it, we could win there. Or it's foreign subversion. It's all that military aid that the United States is pouring in through Pakistan. Or it's, we don't have enough armament in there. Let's put a few more divisions in there or something like that. Or let's send in some more helicopters, you see? Same kind of thinking. Because what is at stake is not just a political or an economic system or a particular culture. It's a mythical hero system. And so, therefore, that, I think, is the deepest level of the shaking of a social security system, because what is happening is events, historical events, are telling Americans who have been on the top of the pile ever since the Second World War that perhaps they are not as powerful or as final or as decent or as wonderful or as obviously heroic as we like to think of ourselves. And that's very disturbing, and therefore there's a lot of anxiety running around in our country. Now that's just a quick profile. I'm trying to look at America as a social security system at many, many different levels. But I think that the end result is the same, that as that social security system shows its human character and its delimitation, and as it's subject to change and to qualification, the anxiety that it keeps in check now is bubbling up, and people are feeling upset, nervous, confused, anxious, and angry, and wondering how to deal with it.